the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Welcome to the Country Hour. We've got a couple of records to talk with you about today. We've got a shearing record from a female shearer. We've got a giant oyster. But I want to start on your farm on the program today. Have you had council planning officers stop changes to your farm? There's an investigation going on in the Victorian Parliament right now, particularly looking at the expansion areas outside major cities, being Melbourne, but also the major regional cities as well, and what can be done to protect Victoria's food supply and agricultural land. Are the laws too draconian? Do they stop things like farm shops? Do they stop things like farming practices on your land? And should the rules be overhauled to make it easier? Is this something that has affected your farming experience? Would love your thoughts on that today. Plus, we'll take to the skies today on the Country Hour. We'll also talk drones and drone development and some developments there that could make farming a little bit easier as well. A whole lot more coming up on the program, but I'd love to hear from you today. What changes on your farm have been stopped by planning laws?
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
In and around Melbourne's Green Wedge in particular, as you're driving in and out of the city, I know it's not great, but we have to do it sometimes. Do you see a lot of farming? I see a lot of land not being used for much. And there are calls to change that. A planning consultant has recommended an overhaul of Victoria's town planning to allow food-producing businesses to build things like farm shops, additional processing, and the greater allowance for farming practices like spreading manure to encourage and protect agricultural land and to produce more food closer to the cities. Would that make it easier for you, even on your farm, even if you're a long way away from the city? Would changes like that make things easier for your farming business to be more nimble and change? I'd love to hear from you. Linda Martin-Chew is a founder of the Rural Planner, a group that specialises in rural planning. She presented to the Victorian Parliament's inquiry into securing the Victorian food supply, which was sitting last Friday and will continue over the weeks ahead, looking at things like planning issues for farming. Here are some of her suggestions on how to make things easier for farmers to produce more food, whether they be on a small plot of land or a really large one.
Planning regulation must support food production activities that are best suited to peri-urban areas. Otherwise, it's more likely that peri-urban land will be converted to uses other than agriculture, leading to permanent land use change. Currently, state planning policy seeks to protect agricultural land without making clear what it should be protected against. That is, what land use and development should be encouraged or discouraged. The peri-urban regions of Victoria are already closely settled, and my submission references a culture and planning that naturalises housing development in the landscape whilst agricultural development is considered out of place. For those occupying the peri-urban landscape for lifestyle purposes, the absence of overt planning policy that provides support for specific farming development practices can be used as a tool to curb productivity on neighbouring farms. Before embarking on a planning career, I was farming in central Victoria for 10 years. The time that elapsed between walking into a local government planning office for my first day of work and having walked off that farm for the last time was only 13 months. So I embarked on my planning career with the realities of day-to-day farm life still very fresh in the memory. And I can remember being shocked to discover how many aspects of farming that I considered to be quite operational triggered a planning permit. The likelihood of a permit being triggered increases with the smaller farming lots that are typical of peri-urban areas because of distances from boundaries, from roads and from houses not in the same ownership. There is just a lot of regulation that relates to farming. 8 years ago, I was at an event addressed by farmers speaking about their journeys with regenerative farming, and all of them were marketing their products directly to consumers, and challenges with planning regulation turned out to be an experience that was common to all of them. Common characteristics of these small-scale and regenerative farm practices are direct marketing from farms, processing on farms, and providing consumers with on-farm experiences that help to educate them about how their food is produced. In addition to providing nutritious food close to the consumer, this type of food production can build community, drive tourism, economic and employment outcomes, increase climate resilience and sustainable land management practices, and address civic health objectives. Speaking to farmers about when and when not to regulate is hard. But in my experience, people operating in those successful farming and agribusiness models that challenge regulators are not seeking to avoid regulation. They know that regulation can support good operators and deter those simply looking for a workaround. Rather, their challenges with planning arise from the almost complete absence of planning policy and guidance for planners assessing their proposals. Being in a regulatory grey area, it means there is, from council, delay, obfuscation or at worst, refusal. My submission recommends that land use planning regulation prioritise peri-urban agriculture over other land uses. A critical part of that task is for regulation to recognise the value to the local food system of small-scale farms, regenerative farming and farm enterprises that facilitate producer-consumer interaction. There's a lot that state government could actually do that is common across all of those Green Wedge and peri-urban councils and have not done to date. But having said that, I would say to local government, don't wait for state government necessarily, because you can, even just through outside the planning scheme, educating your planners. Sometimes they just haven't got the memo. There could be a food policy in a council that's never been actually shared, or there's never been that much effort, or maybe sometimes planning departments are hard to engage with, to say to the planners, we've got this policy over here that says that you should be supporting farm gate stalls and you're refusing them.
Is there a key piece of policy, in your opinion, that is missing to make this all come together and work? Or
I think what's missing is perhaps it's education, perhaps it's having some kind of direct reference to having ancillary activities on farms that relate to farming. Mm-hmm. It's gotten a bit mixed up with the idea of urban uses in rural areas. So if you want to put a farm cafe on to show people how they might actually prepare the food that you've produced, and it brings people to the farm and they can do, you know, they can buy your produce, and that's sometimes perceived as being, well, the farm gate's a shop and the cafe's a food and drink premises, and there are councils that have direct policy against that. So I think it's just understanding that farmers can't be price takers anymore. They have to be able to, especially in peri-urban areas where there is that tourism, and you're trying to make, you know, 60 acres work productively and viably, then you might need to do a bit more intensive, you know, marketing on your property, and even processing your own produce on the property. And all of that involves buildings, everything involves a planning permit, but it involves buildings, it involves something that people, the neighbour, might be able to see, shock horror. And so you have to, once you say in planning policy, this is fine, then it gives less ammunition to the people, the neighbours especially, saying, we don't like the fact that there's cars driving past our property, and we don't like, you know, we can see the farm buildings, and we can see people, and, you know, that's not what we moved here for. We wanted to just sit here and look at the view. You know, there is a lot of that people have to deal with. You know, because I work with applications at site scale as well, I know that there's a lot of issues with neighbour objections to all of this kind of intensification of activity on farms. I just don't think there's enough commitment given, especially in the Green Wedge, to the idea that this land can be used for agriculture.
How do you think planners can be supported across the sector to protect Victoria's food supply system?
Probably education and how food systems work. But I think there's just not enough understanding, especially in peri-urban areas. You have to understand that a lot of the planners who work there live in urban areas and grew up in urban areas. It's not quite as bad out, you know, in Campaspe, Grampians. They're probably more of them might have come from the local area. But there's not a lot of education about what farms look like, and it doesn't help when some policy, local policy in councils, is essentially taking an older view of what farming looks like and is actually prescribing, as much as it can, a kind of hilly landscape with polite numbers of cows and sheep dotted across it, because that kind of farming isn't really making enough money. Mm. So if you're prescribing that landscape, even Yarra Rangers does it to an extent, not wanting netting on trees, you know, visible from the road. It's not a tourist attraction. It is meant to be for growing food. I guess that's my point about making sure that planning is prioritising agriculture. Let's kind of perhaps lower our standards about what we look at and understand how agriculture actually works. Mm.
That's Linda Martin-Chew, who's the founder of the Rural Planner, presenting to the Victorian Parliamentary Inquiry into farm planning, basically. Well, it's actually into the title is the Inquiry into Securing the Victorian Food Supply. Speaking about what laws should be made to make farming easier, things like having a farm shop, things like having additional processing on farm and a greater allowance for things like spreading manure and so forth to protect and encourage agricultural production on land in Melbourne's Green Wedge. You know I love a record. Let's talk records right now on the Country Hour, because a shearer in New South Wales has set a world record for the most amount of merino used, Sean, in an eight-hour period. Janine Kim sheared 358 ewes at an average of 80.8 seconds per sheep, beating an original men's record in the air for that category set in 1999 by 7. She's now owner of the women's world record, and Ondine Slack-Smith caught up with her at the end of her day. Amazing she could talk, but to talk about the incredible effort and the world record.
Initially, I just wanted a challenge. I just wanted to see where I could push myself. The idea of having a long-term goal really, really appealed to me, and I'm very passionate about shearing, so I thought I'd give it a go.
How long have you been shearing?
About 11 years.
How did you first get into it?
My dad is a shearer. He has a property just near Hill End with 5 more merinos. And he's always encouraged all us kids to have a go with whatever we can. So that's where I've sort of gotten my interest from.
I guess, what is it about shearing that you enjoy?
Definitely the people. And it is just the lifestyle of you're your own boss when you're working along. You can make your own wage. And, yeah, it just generally attracts really good people into the industry.
How many sheep did you want to be able to shear today?
Today I sort of had a sort of open sort of target, because I just wanted to see, without the pressure, I just wanted to see what the sheep go with what the sheep were going to shear like. So I didn't have anything initially fully set.
How, I guess, did you prepare physically for today's event?
For the last 12 months I've been doing mobility training and weight training with a UK trainer, a lot of mobility.
What does that look like?
A lot of 4 a.m. starts. Yeah, so a lot of early starts just in the gym at home, just to keep on top of it, and then an 8-hour day shearing.
And I imagine, you know, just as much as that physical fitness, it's really quite a, you know, mental game. How do you go with that?
Yeah, shearing's very much mental, like with your mindset and the way you push yourself. I suppose that's it's just keeping a really good attitude. I feel like no matter what day you're having, you just got to knuckle in and know that you're there for the day and just wear it out.
Yeah, because 8 hours today, that is quite a significant amount of time, and you were doing it on your own. What was going through your head?
Most of it just focusing on what I was doing. A little bit was just blocking out some of the pain and enjoying the support that I'm lucky enough to receive, really.
What were the nerves associated with today? What were they like?
I tried to suppress them as much as I could. This morning I was a little bit shaky, but I tried to use those nerves as adrenaline just to reshape them into motivation.
And how are you feeling now that it's all over?
A bit overwhelmed. Yeah, like it's a bit surreal to know that it's all done and all my work's all paid off, and I get to go celebrate with everyone that's been so gracious and supporting me, really.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's a really big deal, I think, for anyone to be something like this, let alone women, like a woman in an industry where there aren't isn't much female representation. How does it feel to be representing, you know, women in such a way?
Well, really, like, I see so many strong women in the industry, and I hope I do them justice if I'm to be the face for the record. I hope I do them justice, because, yeah, the women that I've always encountered within the industry have just been absolutely incredible, strong people, and, yeah, I hope that I just hope that I do that justice, if that's the case.
How does it feel to be possibly that role model for up and coming?
Oh, I don't know. A bit daunting, I think, actually. Yeah.
Sorry about the audio, but it's just so good to hear records like that and to hear from the people who put in so much effort. Janine Kim there set a world record for a women's 8-hour Merino ewe shearing on the weekend. What were those numbers again? 358 ewes, an average of 80.8 seconds over the 8 hours. Incredible numbers. Great to hear about. On the text line, we've got, hi Warwick, even the issue of building sheds required for farming. The local Swan Hill Council work on improved value. So if you build something, you get hit again and penalised for trying to be productive. That's through rates charges there. When you have wasted land full of box thorns and hardhead next door, having reduced rates, councils need to change their thinking also, says this text. Another one without a name on it. You can check your name on it if you can. Saying a friend of mine bought a parcel of land in Loddonshire with the intention of building a house and living there to make it possible to be on site and conduct a mixed farming enterprise. His building applications have been knocked back because it's under 100 hectares in rural zoning, but the block's always been a separate parcel and it's previously had a house and sheds. The Shire is being completely inflexible. There's some of the thoughts coming in on farming and the laws, planning laws around that. Paul has called from Eden Hope on 1300 977 222 with his thoughts on this. Hi, Paul.
G'day, Warwick. How are you?
I'm good. What did you want to say?
Yeah, well, we're in the West Rimmershire, a little country town called Eden Hope, and we're influenced by the EPBC Act, which is a federal law covering endangered species.
Yes, that's environmental protection, yeah.
That's right. And in this case, it's a red-tailed black cockatoo. And in regards to fencing, technically, we can't clear a fence line without federal approval, even though the local shire come out and assess the native vegetation along the fence line, it still shouldn't be done without federal approval. And they deem certain trees, especially red gums, that any of the variety, red gum, bull oak, stringy bark or white gum, as future habitat for the red tail, and yet we've got fence lines there that had limbs dropped on them, and under the 1968 Fencing Act, even though the trees are on the government side or the roadside, we're still technically, we have to cover whatever limbs drop off on our fences.
So how does it work in reality then for you, Paul?
It's very difficult, Warwick, because if you go away and a limb drops on your fence and all of a sudden you've got livestock on the road, you're actually accountable for that.
So is there if you want to clear your fence line, do you have to get an assessment from someone at the federal level, or is that does it just not work like that in practice?
No, the law is that you have to get federal approval to clear native vegetation under the EPBC Act if you're deemed an endangered species in that shire.
I've covered issues of the clearing fence lines in the past too. These are things that end up in court, Paul.
They end up in court, most definitely.
Yeah, so how would you make the system better? Because
you really need a second party, being the Shire, to be realistic about us being able to clear a fence line. Sure, trees can fall over, but if you clear it, like the common sense is to have a combination width of 4 standard metres, which is about a bulldozer width, which is adjacent shires to the West Rimmera, being the Horsham Regional, they can go and clear their fence lines without any trouble at all. But we can't, and it just seems really unfair that we have to deal with that, and yet the adjacent neighbours don't have to deal with that problem.
And I'd imagine, are you empathetic to those who are making the rules? They're trying to protect animals and not have, you know, endangered wildlife die on their watch, and that's why these rules are in place in the first place?
I'm empathetic for the red-tailed black cockatoo, but you've also got to be empathetic for the actual farmer trying to deal with this. And how can you justify a shire that's less than 2 k's away, or in some cases where you own land on the border of both shires, they can do it and we can't?
Paul, really interesting. Thanks for putting it on the plate.
Good on you, Warwick.
Paul there at Eden Hope. There we go. Got it out. 1300 977 222 is the number Paul called. We're talking council regulations today, planning regulations, because evidence before a Victorian government inquiry says rules need to be changed to make it easier, as farming practices have changed, easier to have things like a farm shop, easier to have things like spreading manure as a farming practice allowed in these peri-urban areas where there's going to be a lot of houses around it. And it's got me asking you, what planning laws would you change to make it easier for farming? What's frustrating you? Have you been knocked back for something? 1300 977 222. You can text 2 0467 842 722. Let's talk insects right now on the program, because farmers have access to an updated information on the toxicity levels of insecticides to beneficial insects. The beneficials chemical toxicity table, say that five times fast, updated by CSER Australia, rates the impact of insecticides on beneficial insects from low impact to very high impact. Beneficial insects can play a significant role in controlling pests in cropping systems, but are often the unintended victims of insecticide sprays. Angus Verley caught up with Dr. Rosie Knapp, research scientist at CSER Australia, about the guide.
The beneficials toxicity table it's really just a summary of the toxicity of different insecticides against beneficial insects, important to the grains industry in particular. The table's been around for a little while now. We first launched it in 2022, but we've been updating it annually each year with new data coming out of our labs from our own bioassay testing of insecticides. In the latest update of the table, which was made live last week, we've actually filled all data gaps now in the table. So we're excited to include new data on hoverflies and spiders in particular into the table, which are both really important beneficials for agriculture.
So the table is essentially a quick reference where farmers, when they're planning to use whatever insecticides they may be, they can go to the table and quickly figure out how little or how harmful that particular insecticide can be to various insects.
Yeah, exactly. So what we've really done is tried to summarize all of the information out there and our own research into a really accessible resource, which you can just get the information from at a glance. So there's a lot of data backing it, but we've brought this all together to give each insecticide a rating of toxicity going from low to medium to high to very high in terms of how it will impact different important beneficial insects. So yeah, it's just really there to kind of help users navigate the different information in this space.
And can you just explain a bit about what you mean by beneficial insects and why farmers don't want to be killing those particular insects?
Yeah, absolutely. So beneficial insects, when we talk about beneficials, we kind of mean any insect which is not a pest to the crop. So these can be things like pollinators, or they can be natural predators of crop pests. So having these different species around is actually really useful for farmers, because they do a really good job of kind of naturally keeping pest populations at bay. They're already naturally occurring in quite a lot of agricultural situations. And what we kind of really want to avoid is accidentally wiping these kind of good guys out when we're trying to spray insecticides to control for the pests. So it kind of helps unpick that a little bit and help farmers to identify pesticides which are going to be good against the pests, but they're going to keep a nice healthy population of beneficials as well.
So as a minimum, farmers don't want to be killing insects if they don't have to, but then beyond that, they could actually be creating themselves problems if they're killing insects that are out there doing a good job and controlling pests for them.
Yeah, exactly. You can kind of end up shooting yourself in the foot a bit if you spray something too hard. You wipe away all the pests and all of the things that are controlling the pests. So if the spray isn't completely effective and the pests bounce back, you've then wiped out one of your lines of defense against those pests. So in some situations, especially if you've got pests which are resistant to insecticides, you can actually sometimes end up doing more harm than good.
And just how effective can some of these beneficial insects be at controlling some of the pests?
They really vary. They can be very, very kind of targeted control agents of the pests. So things like aphid parasitoids in particular, these are wasps which they've evolved to specifically target aphids. So they have a really strong kind of host-specific relationship. If you've got aphid parasitoids around, the aphids do not really stand a chance. We are kind of ongoing research into actually quantifying the impacts in the field. But all in all, it's just good to keep populations of these beneficials healthy.
And can it be a tricky balancing act for farmers when, of course, they're wanting to use the most effective insecticide for the job, but then also weighing up what potential harm it might have to those beneficials?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a difficult thing to balance. So we've kind of tried to just present the information in as straightforward a way as possible to at least help some element of that decision-making process.
That's Dr. Rosie Knapp, research scientist at CSER Australia, speaking there with Angus Verley about beneficial insects. And we'll stay with Angus right now, actually, because Angus has rural news for you today. Good afternoon, Angus.
G'day, Woz. A mega purchase of an Australian tomato grower has been completed. Giant glasshouse development Katunga Fresh near Shepparton in northern Victoria has sold to Australasian real estate fund manager Centuria. The 21-hectare site will add to Centuria's tomato holdings, which are now larger than 100 hectares. The deal, believed to be worth around $100 million, is a sale and lease back with the business to still be operated by the Vandengore family. A new cattle price indicator is being launched today. Meat and Livestock Australia is launching the NICI, its National Young Cattle Indicator, on day one of Beef Australia in Rockhampton. MLA says the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator, or ECI, has been interpreted as a catch-all for the market, despite the indicator shifting in recent years. Market Information Manager Steve Bignall says the NICI will provide valuable information to producers.
So the NICI is a new indicator, the National Young Cattle Indicator, and what it is, it's a truly national restocker indicator. At the present, we have the ECI, and that looks at processors, feedlots and restockers all in one indicator, and it sort of aggregates them, and so it can be difficult for producers to understand what the price of the category of animal they're selling is actually going for. So this is really a restocker indicator on a national basis that'll give those producers selling animals in the restocker market a guide to what they're worth. Actually, our first indicator that includes both physical sales and online sales. So it will capture physical and online restocker animals over 20 kilos that are veelers, weaners and yearlings of both heifers and steers and non-station mated animals.
Western Australian sheep producers have called on their state government to provide a freight rebate for sending sheep east, given the current climate. It's been a tumultuous year for the state's sheep producers, with low prices, dry seasonal conditions, and a live export ban looming. But a meeting with WA's Premier late last week has given farmers a bit of light at the end of the tunnel. WA's Sheep and Beef Chairperson, Dave Vandenberg, was at that meeting and says a short-term solution like a rebate would ease pressure on WA's processors, producers, and paddocks.
The major abattoirs are above capacity from previous years, so they're working as virtually as hard as they can. Live export, more live export. You know, we may get an extra boat, but it's not enough, not enough. To move what we need to move, probably the major and what everyone agreed was getting more sheep to the eastern states. And the problem is that the freight cost is greater than what the animal's worth. So if they're buying animals from WA to go to New South Wales, they're probably maybe getting a $20 or $30 animal and then $30 or $40 freight. So all of a sudden, it's not a cheap animal. We're hoping that maybe some sort of freight rebate would allow us to move some more animals, and that would be attractive to those eastern states.
After 55 years farming oysters and five attempts at a world record, Bernie Connell and his oyster named Jill are on track to enter the history books after the weekend's Naruma Oyster Festival. Jill the oyster is almost a decade old and weighs in at a whopping 3.01 kilograms. That's almost double the current record of 1.6 kilograms set in Denmark in 2013. On Saturday, Bernie claimed Australia's biggest oyster award at the festival, taking out first, second and third place. He says the win and the record mean he and Jill can retire from competitions as champions.
and she was 5-6 times bigger than anything else. So you know that's a fast grower, so you put her aside, only for shows and all that sort of thing.
How do you make an oyster heavy? What's the trick?
The main thing is what they eat. And in the river there's 18 different types of algae. And the Sydney Rock eats 3. This one eats a lot. They never stop eating, they're just pumping all the time. And we've been trying 5 years. Every year we come, they ring them and torment them, the Guinness Book of Record. So this year they're acknowledging that she'll get the world record if she wins. Well, the, you know, 55 years of doing it, I've got nothing else, only hard work. And that's my claim to fame. For 1 hour, the heaviest oyster in the world.
And Woz, that's it for Rural News.
Angus, I hope you and anyone out there can find someone to talk about you the way Bernie talks about Jill the oyster. That is lovely to hear. Bernie, 3.01 kilogram oyster. New world record being confirmed by Guinness World Records as we speak. I love that story. Plenty of your texts coming in on planning around planning laws and farms in Australia. This one says, Warwick, I'm unsure who's to blame, but our engineering business in Knive has been trying to build a shed and move. It's been years and still red tape or goalposts shift. He's landlocked in amongst houses and trying to get a bit of out-of-town boundaries to a better spot for all. The community want this as it will be much better for all. And it's costing him a fortune. It's in the West Wimmera Shire at Kniver. Thanks very much for that. This one says, Northern Grampians still similar regulations, can't build on less than 200 hectares. One farmer has a number of 40-acre blocks adjoining the town boundary that have been on individual titles since the mid-1800s, but you're not allowed to be built to build on them, says Chris. Jeff says, the future of agriculture in Victoria is a nightmare with ever-increasing regulations and compliance costs. Like Shire rates, it drives the nails in the coffin. And it goes on from there. I'll read more of your texts as we go through the afternoon. But what planting laws could be changed to help agriculture as well? A lot of frustration out there at the moment. There's an inquiry looking at it. We heard some suggestions in front of it earlier in the program. What would you suggest? 1300 977 222 to call or send a text 0467 842 722. Stephanie Miles can tell you about the weather. And it's still blue sky and not much rain out my window in Shepparton, Stephanie.
Yeah, very much for me as well, Warwick. How are you today?
I'm really, really good. What's it looking like for this week in Victoria's weather?
Definitely. Okay, so we're still under the influence of that high-pressure ridge over the state, so still very settled conditions. And look, we've got a lot of cloud in the south with those southeasterly winds, sorry, continuing. A couple of showers over Gippsland as well, but you're right, there's a lot of sunshine around the state. And those temperatures kind of sticking around the low 20s, even a high teens for, you know, southern parts of the state. But look, it's relatively settled out there. We had some widespread fog this morning as well. Now, like I said, because of that high pressure ridge, we've got very similar conditions on Tuesday and Wednesday once again. So expect, you know, those widespread fogs in the morning as well, mainly over the southern parts, and then we get some cloudier, just a little bit of cloud, to be honest, to developing throughout that morning period, and then we get quite a lot of sunshine in the afternoon for both those Tuesdays and Wednesday timeframes. And those temperatures are very similar once again in the high teens and the low 20s for Tuesday, Wednesday. It's from Thursday, Warwick, that we kind of get a little bit of a change in our weather. We're still remaining under that high pressure ridge, but the northern parts of our state will probably get a little bit more cloudy. There is a bit of a trough that's deepening over the eastern parts of Australia, and it could influence a couple of drops of light rain in those northern parts, particularly the Mallee and the Northern Country and maybe even the Northeast District. But look, at the moment, it's quite uncertain how much rainfall is really going to move a little bit further south towards our state and rather might just stick over New South Wales at this stage. So that's on Thursday and Friday, and that kind of continues into Saturday as well. But then by Sunday, we've mostly got back into those southeasterlies with the ridge that's dominating. It's just going to be from Thursday, Friday, Saturday that we've really got our eye on potentially some rainfall in the northern part.
Oh, well, yeah, we'll keep an eye out then for it. Warnings-wise, anything around today or into tomorrow?
No warnings around at the moment. Look, we've got some cooler temperatures tomorrow morning, so there could be a couple of patches of frost in the northeast tomorrow around the Ori-Wodonga area once again, and then again on Wednesday a little bit further east, but otherwise there's no real warnings out there at the moment, Warren.
Brilliant. Stephanie, thanks very much for the update.
Thank you. Speak to you later.
Stephanie Miles there, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology in a very settled period for the weather. always a good chance for you to ask a question. You should text a question through to the text line if you want to know anything about the weather. But with not much happening, it's probably not much you want to know, right? Let's talk 3G. Let's talk telecommunications in your area as well, because big news: Telstra is delaying the shutdown of its 3G network by 2 months. Originally planned for June 30, it's now going to happen on the 31st of August, partly because the company says there's a large number of people still using 3G. David Claughton called up with Chana Seneviratna, who's in charge of technology development at Telstra, about the delay and what it means particularly to regional customers.
Even though we announced our closure 5 years ago and we've been upgrading our network and that's progressing well, we realise that even as of now, we've still got something like 200,000 handsets on the 3G network which haven't been upgraded yet. And so we wanted to kind of give our customers 2 more months and we've decided to delay the closure until the 31st of August.
Why do you think people have been slow to change their handsets over?
Look, honestly, I don't know. I mean, in some cases, I think maybe the message hasn't got through. Even though we've been talking about it for 5 years, we've advertised on multiple channels, we've actually contacted them directly, you know, via text message, etc. And partly it may be human nature that people just kind of wait till the last minute. But what we've done in the last few weeks, first in early April, we released a SMS checker. So what you have to do is to text the number 3 to 3498 from your handset, and it will tell you if your handset will work on our network after the 31st of August. That's one measure. And we've had something like 80,000 hits on that, and 90% of people who've texted to that number have got compliant devices, but there's still 10% turned up that they were told you need to upgrade. Now, in addition to that, we will release next week, from about the 15th of May, if you have one of those devices that need to be upgraded, when you make a call, you will be played a very short message that says, hey, you need to upgrade your device. It won't work after the 31st of August. And so that's, if you like, really, you know...
That'll be a clear warning, won't it? And do you think customers have got an adequate options out there in terms of upgrading their device for a reasonable price, particularly when you get into this kind of area of remote and rural service where you do need a pretty good handset?
Yeah, look, we think we have. I mean, we've got a range of devices, and particularly those with the blue tick capability, and we also recognize that there are some customers who don't necessarily want a really expensive smartphone, so we have got a couple of options which are available through our retail channels, which are, if you like, some of the old-fashioned sort of flip phones, and they're sort of retailing, you know, the cheapest of them retails for around $60.
And what about loss of service after this switch from 4G to 5G, because that's been happening already, hasn't it? Telstra's been going around the country, as have Optus and others, to change the equipment over to 4 and 5G, but some people are experiencing loss of service. So what's happening there?
So if they are, like when we do the upgrade, we advise the community that there will be a temporary shutdown of the site while we do the upgrade. When we finish the upgrade, we bring back, obviously, whatever the new capabilities, whether it's 4G or 5G, but we absolutely bring back 3G. So we have said very clearly, we will not shut down the 3G network until we have demonstrated to ourselves that we have got 4G equivalent coverage wherever there's 3G. So the loss of service, it should only be temporary while the upgrades are continuing.
And how, in terms of that progressive work, have you been around to every tower now in the country, or is there still a fair few to go?
We have, at this point in time, just over 100 towers left to upgrade. And like we've always said, that from a network perspective, we would have all our network upgraded to 4G, where we have 3G only, by the 30th of June, and we're on track to complete that.
There will be some people who, by good luck really, rather than proper coverage planning, get a 3G service at the moment, but they may not be on the coverage map for 3G, which is really, that's your promise, isn't it? You will make sure that there's 4G coverage wherever there's people are on the map. But there are a number of people that are not on the map that are getting 3G currently, have invested quite a lot of money into using that service and getting the equipment they need to run it. What will happen to those people?
So, you know, what we've clearly said is that we will provide 4G equivalent coverage in accordance with the published map. And so if there are people who are getting coverage outside of that area, there is obviously the chance that they will lose that coverage. If people are using 3G beyond it, that's called fortuitous coverage.
So they'll drop off, you think?
Yeah, well, they will drop off. I mean, in some cases, they may not, David. I mean, because the spectrum, so this is all dictated by the laws of physics, you know, in terms of the propagation that, you know, so if people are getting this fortuitous coverage, it's because the 3G coverage is propagating beyond the published coverage map and, you know, you're getting a whiff of coverage somewhere. Now, that's at what we call the low band, so that's at 850 meg. Now, 4G is a bit low, actually, so at 700 meg. So there is a possibility you will get the same, you know, little bit of fortuitous coverage from 4G as well.
And some people are experiencing a change to their 3G coverage when 4G towers go up or the new equipment's put up. And sometimes it's like when they're at the bottom of the hill and the 4G signal's now booming across the range to reach some population, you know, hotspot. They're in the Fresnel zone, we've heard people refer to. What can those people do if they suddenly can't get access to the 3G anymore, they can't get the 4G because they're in this funny pocket?
Well, if there are people who have had experience a loss of service as a result of any upgrade, we are encouraging people to contact us. We have an engineering team who are ready to investigate any anomalies, and we work with various the National Farmers Federation, Isolated Children's Organizations, where we've been telling them the same story, that, you know, if any of their, stakeholders experience any problems, then they have to contact, you know, please contact us. We've got people in regional Australia, the regional general managers, and they've got advertised numbers. We want to hear from them. We want to hear as soon as possible, and particularly with the extension of 2 months, we would encourage them to contact us so that we can investigate.
It's Channa Seneviratna from Telstra speaking to David Claughton there. Those warning messages about the 3G shutoff will continue, but as you heard, not June 30 anymore. Now the 31st of August is the planned shutdown for the 3G network from Telstra. You're listening to The Country Hour. It is 12 to 1. Warwick Long with you. Let's talk drones now before I get back to a few of your texts about planning. In just a few months, the world's first drone livestock monitor is expected to launch, and it's all the brainchild of a Gippsland drone photographer. Edward Barraclough created Drone Hand when his dad, who's in his 80s and still farming in New South Wales, asked if it was possible to use Edward's drone to keep an eye on his flock. Fiona caught up with Edward a few months ago about the development of that technology. This is what they were chatting about then.
We've built that AI model. We've done a whole lot of customer research and validation. Right now, we're working with developers here in Melbourne to integrate the AI model into the flight control app. Now, I just pop one of these drones up. When we use this for the animals, I generally fly it about 100 metres up, and that way the animals tend not to react at all. They don't seem to notice it. Yeah. But you will notice as it takes off, it's a little loud.
So that's it in action. Edward caught up with Fiona Broom recently to say, well, that software is now just a couple of months away from official launch.
We have an autonomous drone platform, so it's software for drones to autonomously check farms for their livestock and infrastructure like their fencing and water sources.
You've been doing the expo circuits. You've been out to all of the ag tech and ag innovation expos. What kind of feedback are you getting from farmers?
From the farmers that come, they usually have a real interest in ag tech to start with. That's drawn them here. And that's been a great response. More so with these types of events, it's that one conversation that makes all the difference, that one lead that connects you to a broader group or that one industry partner who wants to collaborate in some way.
When we did catch up back in January, you had just gotten a grant. You weren't able to talk about the details then. Can you tell us about it now?
Yeah, that was really exciting, and I really wanted to tell you then, but I couldn't. I got the AgTech grant from LaunchVic, and LaunchVic are a really amazing organisation in Victoria here, doing heaps of work to support young and innovators in agriculture. So that was a huge boost to our confidence and a huge boost for us financially to keep moving forward.
Have you technically launched, officially launched, or that's still to come?
No, we haven't technically launched. We are 2 months away from launch, so we're planning for a launch in June. And right now we've completed all of our technical hurdles. We are just finishing off the user-facing side of the application, making sure it looks good and it's all friendly to use.
And when you do officially kick off, how many people do you kind of have on your wait list who are ready and waiting to start using the software?
Yeah, our wait list is getting quite long now. It's great. We've got a number of early adopters. I think we're up to 8 or 9 early adopters already signed on. But our wait list of general users is really growing every day. It's been great. And it's I've been amazed by the response, to be honest. It was always a risk doing something new in ag tech. And I just love the way that Australian farmers are willing to innovate and take on new methods, really, to make their lives easier.
There's a lot of chat here at the Future Ag Expo about drones and how they can be used on farm. And I was actually having a chat with one of our Gippsland farmers who's from some pretty hilly country. And he reckons that drones are really going to come in handy on sort of tough terrain where you can't get a plane in or you can't get a helicopter in for spraying. Is that where drones really are going to come into their own, do you think?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that's the case for all automation. We're needing to provide more food, more produce from smaller land areas in greater challenges. Using autonomous means, whether that's drones or even robotics, which can be implemented at a tenth of the cost of the big machinery and get into places like hilly areas, scrubby areas, areas that, you know, are risking your machinery, are risking your staff. It's definitely where we're going with the way these types of automations are becoming cheaper and easier to use.
You've got another event that's just been added to your calendar coming up in May. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it's really exciting. I was offered a place on the startup alley of Beef Week. And Beef Week is a massive event. Every 4 years takes over the town of Rockhampton. And apparently it's the thing in beef. It is all the cattle producers in Australia will go out there and take over the town for a full week. To be offered that spot, to be given that stand, is a real opportunity for us.
That's Drone Hand founder Edward Barraclough speaking with Fiona Broome when we caught up with him at the Future Ag Summit. Beef Week on this week, so we know where Edward is. We know how busy he's going to be. We'll have plenty of content and interviews coming from Beef Week from our colleagues in the Queensland Country Hour over the next week or so, so stay tuned and watch out for that. A couple of your texts coming in just before we go to markets. Hi, Warwick, across the Victorian Murray River border opposite Swan Hill in New South Wales, the Shire won't allow a building permit under 500 hectares in New South Wales, unless it's in a town. No wonder the population is falling in that shire, says Greg from Swan Hill. This one says 80% plus of the Victorian population are now urban-based, on-ground, practical, experience-based management people are hard to find. Models don't replace reality. They suggest potential outcomes. Overtaxing, over-management regulations, over-bureaucracy, over-governance created over-cost, over-restrictive outcomes, waste valuable time and finance to appease, and that stops food and on-ground production. The more they put on rural production, the worse the outcome. And this one goes, I'd turn endangered species into my advantage. Create a corridor and find a company who wants to support and pay biodiversity protection, ESG. Planning schemes are a farce manipulated by the interpretation, and the interpretation manipulated by the motive. Usually the most money wins, says that text, which goes on from there. But I need to get to markets.
$7.50, $70, thank you.
Here you go.
We have a few to get through today. We'll start in Mortlake with the cattle there. Take it away, Chris Agnew.
Thanks, Warwick. Due to the prevailing dry conditions, there was a sharp increase up to 1,992 head at Mortlake, an increase of 703 on last week's offering. Not all the regular processes were present, but there was some restocker interest. The market was firm for most categories. However, cows lost 30 to 40 cents and more so in places for lighter cows. The plain and secondary cattle were softer by 30 to 40 cents and bulls lost 20 cents. A small number of vealers made from 285 to 322, trade steers and heifers making between 290 and 322, and the grown cattle topped at 332 cents. Manufacturing steers sold up to 258. The heavy beef cows making from 180 to 242, medium cows 140 to 175. Well-covered dairy cows making between 175 and 216. At Mortlake, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Some interesting numbers there. Thanks very much for that, Chris. Let's go to Wagga Cattle and see if there's a similar story. Here's Leanne Dax.
Good afternoon. Numbers jumped up to 4,500. Demand this week lifted for cattle weighing 500 to 600 kilo, with all domestic buyers eager for a market share. Secondary cattle sold to mixed trends, with the heifer portion to feed on slipping in value. Lighter weight cattle were in greater numbers, mostly due to the drying conditions, and prices slipped back 20 to 30 cents for both the steers and heifers. Feeder heifers, medium weight, were back 15 cents, 230 to 310. Feeder steers, medium weight, were firm, 290 to 371. The lighter weights topped at 361. Heifers and steers to the trade, only a few, 255 to 328. Heavy kill steers, $3 to 328, lifting 15 cents. Bullocks, 256 to 315, easing 5. Heavy cows were back 8 to 10, 225 to 250. And the middle runner leaner types, 178 to 225. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. Let's go to Pakenham Cattle and Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Warwick. Numbers increased to 1,380. That's 620 more, with a few orders absent from the buying group in a dearer market in places. Quality was mixed, with many cattle lacking finish. Trade cattle were in short supply, selling up to 30 cents dearer where quality allowed. Grown steers and bullocks lifted 20. Manufacturing steers gained 10 to 25. Heavy beef cows held firm, while dairy lots eased 10 to 15 cents, with processors loading cows for an estimated 361 to 498 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls lifted 10. Vealers sold from 223 to 384. Yearling trade steers 320 to 360. The heifer portion 258 to 350. Grown steers 282 to 340. Bullocks 316 to 351. Heavy Frisian manufacturing steers 230 to 270. Crossbreds 220 to 320. Most light and medium weight cows 129 to 225. Heavyweights 182 to 268, heavy bulls 250 to 277. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Brendan. Lucky last, Jenny Kelly's at Bendigo with the sheep and lambs.
Good afternoon. Lamb market lost traction again today, with the best heavy and trade lambs quoted as $5 to $8 easier, but plainer lambs in untidy skins are not finished as well, dropped by $10 and up to $20 a head as buyers become selective again. There was more weight in the yarding, with a top of $252 for big lambs estimated around 38-40 kilos carcass weight. Overall, the ballpark quote for good processing lambs was 640 to 670 cents a kilo, with just odd pence higher. Once onto the plainer trade processing lambs, the rate was more 600 to 640 cents. Most of the bigger export lambs, $190 to $235 a head, and the good heavy trades, $145 to $175. In the sheep, the market had some stronger spots early on for heavy ewes, with crossbreds reaching over $120. But the market in general was stable at a quote of 260 to 280 cents a kilo carcass weight, still keeping most sheep in that sort of $50 to $100 a head mark. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Thanks, Jenny. Mick on the text line says, talking about records, was there was a local footy game in Adelaide where a team won 516 to nil on the weekend. Oh, Mick, thanks for sending it through. That's tough. Hey, and congratulations to the Tractor Boys, my soccer team. They were promoted on the weekend.